Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The news of the day today comes from the National Labor Relations Board. It turns out college football players are university employees, which means that sound you hear is a whole big can of worms being opened up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 26th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us. So here's what happened in this case. Not too long ago, a bunch of football players at Northwestern University tried to unionize. They were, they said, basically employees upon whose labor the school and the NCAA and countless others make big piles of money. Northwestern said, no, you're not employees. Today, the regional office of the National Labor Relations Board said, yes, they are too. It will be appealed to the main NLRB offices in Washington, but if it does stand, this ruling is the proverbial big deal. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Explain the rationale here, would you, that these players are employees of the university?
Well, Mr. Orr, who is the director of the regional National Labor Relations Office in Chicago, gave the rationale that the players are employees because they receive compensation. And the compensation that he referred to is scholarships, grant and aids, which are valued at $61,000 roughly, and that the players are subject to the employer's control in the performance of their duties, and that their duties benefit their employer, Northwestern University. So this is consistent with really the history of the NCAA. At the beginning of the NCAA in 1905, they stipulated no scholarships at all because scholarships were a form of compensation and our students are going to be amateurs. The NCAA changed that rule around the late 1940s.
If this stands, and it will be appealed, as I said, the school has already said so, how large is that can of worms it is going to open? This it could be pay, it could be withholding of labor. I mean, there's all kinds of things that employees get to do.
Yes. Well, the first thing is that the ruling, if it is appealed and upheld, only applies to private colleges.
Uh-huh.
Most of the schools in FBS, the Football Bowl Subdivision of Division I, 124 such schools, the large majority of them are state schools and would not be directly affected. If the players do unionize at Northwestern and if they ask for wages as such, then the NCAA will disqualify them on the grounds that the NCAA and college sports are amateur and they can't be paid. But if they do something else, which is to say that they want a cost of living adjustment or they want to have catastrophic injury insurance for those players who are injured and can't go on to play in the pros, then they could stay within the NCAA rules and presumably they could then trigger other universities that are private to also unionize and to ask for the same things. I think the larger issue here is that this is a momentum for reform of the NCAA that has been building, and this simply pushes that further along.
Is this the big one then for the NCAA? I mean, it's been taking a lot of hits lately.
I don't know if this is bigger than the other things. This is simply something that's pushing the momentum along, and it remains to be seen after it's appealed and a decision is made at the national level where it's all leading.
Do you believe the NCAA has been, if not burying its head in the sand, then hoping this whole thing goes away? Have they been actively trying to do something about this? You know, labor and
well, they and yes, so they're anticipating a lot of this stuff, and there is some movement for reform. But yes, I think the NCAA has been burying its head in the sand. It's trying very, very modestly now to do something about it. But when you have college coaches who are paid $5, $6, $7, $8, $9 million a year, which is as much or more than the professional coaches, which are coaching for professional teams that generate 5 or 10 times as much as the college teams, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's crying out about the exploitation of these athletes. So there's a movement that I don't think is going to stop very easily here.
Andrew Zimbalist, a sports economist at Smith College. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, down all the way around, especially the NASDAQ again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Mark Zuckerberg has made another big acquisition. He has spent $2 billion in cash and stock for a startup called Oculus VR. They make virtual reality headsets. And you'll notice I said Zuckerberg bought them, not Facebook, the company he runs, because Zuckerberg has pretty much total control at Facebook. So what Mark wants, Mark gets. $1 billion for Instagram, $19 billion for WhatsApp. The list could go on. Zuckerberg has become, in essence, a very public private venture capitalist. Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
Facebook is buying a virtual reality company? Really?
They're really trying to become a holding company, if you will, to own a key stake in all the major platforms for social connection.
David Rogers teaches at Columbia Business School. The idea isn't that Facebook thinks people want to like one another's comments in virtual reality. It's that virtual reality is up and coming and Facebook wants in.
That's all fine, well, and good.
David Nelson is chief strategist with Bellpoint Asset Management. He says, fine if Facebook wants to take a venture capitalist approach to acquisitions, but as an investor, he wants to see hard numbers of value.
They're unable to do that. They're just kind of saying, trust us, this is going to be amazing. And we're looking 5, 6, 7, even 10 years out for the return. I think that's too far, at least for me. I sold my stock after the WhatsApp deal.
This not uncommon reaction may involve a difference in culture when it comes to innovation. This is according to Victor Huang, CEO of T2 Venture Creations. It's a Silicon Valley venture firm.
On Wall Street, the biggest fear is missing the numbers, not making earnings. In Silicon Valley, in the startup world, the biggest fear is obsolescence, because obsolescence is the equivalent of death.
He says looking only at a future earnings stream misses the cost of not innovating.
It wasn't that long ago that Microsoft was the cool company, and now people think of it as a dinosaur.
All of that said, an investment of $2 billion is no small gamble. Unfortunately, hindsight is the only way to see if it pays off. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Here's today's Marketplace public service announcement. Stay healthy out there, everybody, will you? Stay very healthy, because hospitals around the country are running short on some pretty basic drugs. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
The drip drip of IV fluid at hospitals, the drug they give you when you have a heart attack, medicines for cancer patients, all in short supply. Cynthia Riley is with the American Society of Health System Pharmacists.
On any given day, we're tracking usually in the range of 300 drug products that are in shortage.
She says right now, the shortage of IV fluid is at the top of everyone's critical list.
It's almost really like not having access to water.
Yeah, it's that essential. Aaron Fox is director of drug information at the University of Utah Hospitals and Clinics.
When we run out of absolute basics, like we're running out of right now, that's when things get really frustrating.
According to a report from the Government Accountability Office, the number of shortages tripled between 2007 and 2012. 60% of the shortages are generic drugs, cheaper drugs.
Drug manufacturing in the U.S. is a business. No company has an obligation to make any product, no matter how essential it is for patients.
Captain Valerie Jensen is the Associate Director for Drug Shortages at the FDA. She says the number of new shortages has been falling since new rules went into place in 2012. But
some shortages are just not able to be avoided.
Which is kind of hard to fathom in a wealthy country like the U.S. But some of these drugs are only produced by one or two companies. When a manufacturing line shuts down or demand goes up, we run low. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
One of Washington, D.C.'s biggest industries has happened upon some interesting times. Lobbying still does involve money and power and schmoozing over multi-course meals, but Marketplace's David Gura reports that a slow economy and a slower Congress have changed the way the influence business works.
Lobbyist Rich Gold meets me in the bar at the Willard. That's an old hotel where the term lobbying is said to have been coined. Back in the 1870s, Gold's professional forebears plied President Grant with cigars and booze. So as I sit down with Gold, I'm wondering, vodka or gin?
I guess in some ways I'm kind of the breakthrough generation. I have never had a martini at lunch.
So ice water it is. Gold has been lobbying for 2 decades for trade groups and for a handful of cities, including Atlanta and Charlotte. And Gold says the culture of lobbying has changed.
There's no walking into a back room anymore and saying, I need this, tapping the table and getting it done.
And the economic downturn also affected lobbying, Gold says, after 15 years of growth.
The recession came late to Washington, and end of 2010, 2011, 2012 were relatively lean years, and we're seeing that in D.C. with some brand name firms really struggling now.
Lawmaking specialists are less valuable than they once were.
Jerry Sikorsky is one of Gold's colleagues. He lobbies for an insurance company and for a few Native American tribes. We meet in a cafeteria on Capitol Hill, where martinis aren't on the menu, by the way. Sikorsky, who used to represent Minnesotans in Congress, says the federal government is still operating. It's still buying things, it's still regulating industries and collecting taxes.
What's changed is the overarching lawmaking, policymaking pieces of it aren't happening.
Sikorsky says you can't fundamentally reinvent yourself, but you can adjust, and many lobbyists have had to. What firms look for in lobbyists these days is expertise in a particular subject matter. Mike House runs the legislative practice at Hogan Lovells, and his lobbying portfolio includes some petroleum companies, Nissan, and the BCS, the Bold Championship Series. And House says there are fewer lobbyists than there used to be.
You know, business is down. I think all the statistics have shown that. I think business is down about 3%, if I'm not mistaken, over last year.
Lawmakers are spending more time away from Washington. Last year, there were just 159 legislative days when the House of Representatives was in session. And Congress isn't passing many bills. Last year, just 87 became law. So a lobbyist like House adjusts.
We always say Washington goes legislation, regulation, litigation, legislation.
He says this is the regulation stage right now. There's financial reform rule writing, there's the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and even though the legislative process is moving slowly, it is moving. There are people interested in tax reform, for example.
That'll be a 2 to 4, maybe even a 6-year process when it's all said and done. But the smart people get in early.
More firms are taking what they call a multidisciplinary approach to lobbying. Lobbyists work hand-in-hand with lawyers, and some firms hire strategic communications consultants. Back on the Hill, I meet Dan Bryant in a Senate office building. He heads the lobbying practice at Covington and Burling. His specialty is beverages. Bryant lobbies for Monster Energy Drinks and PepsiCo, the company he used to work for. And the relatively light legislative load doesn't seem to faze him.
The need to be explaining your business more clearly, more in a more compelling way, has never been more important, both in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Public policy, Bryant says, has become more global, so his firm has grown its business overseas. It just expanded its office in Brussels to lobby European governments, and because many foreign companies want to lobby the U.S.
I think as long as governments and government officials are making decisions that affect the public and that affect the business community, there will be lobbying.
Though what it involves will continue to change. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up, what to buy the cold warrior who has everything.
If you really wanted to impress somebody, you melted down brass casings of bullets and gave them as a state gift.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back what it gained yesterday, slid 98 points, did the blue chip 0.6%, closed at 16,268. The S&P 500 off 12 points, 0.7%, ended things at 1852. The tech-heavy NASDAQ continued its volatile streak, dropped 60 points on this day, 1.4%. Finished at 41.73. In reality, folks, we're not cheering Facebook's virtual gaming purchase of Oculus, as we were telling you. Shares in Facebook dropped nearly 7% today. There's a Bloomberg report that the CEO of Dish Network recently contacted DirecTV about a tie-up in the satellite TV business. Shares of both companies up about 6%. And this one I kind of have to do, so here goes. I apologize in advance. Candy got crushed. King Digital's share price fell more than 15% today in its first day of trading. The maker of Candy Crush Saga opened at $22.50 a share, closed at $19. Ouch, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its final fourth quarter gross domestic product report. The National Association of Realtors releases its February pending home sales index. And speaking of homes, Graceland, home to Elvis Presley, was declared a National Historic Landmark 8 years ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The civil war in Syria is in its fourth year now and has brought about the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. More than 2.5 million people are refugees, exiled to places like Jordan and Lebanon and Iraq. 6.5 million more are displaced inside the country. And it's hard to square that with this. Aid groups say private donations to Syrian victims are surprisingly low, so those groups are rethinking how they appeal to the public. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
Earlier this month, as part of an appeal for Syria, Save the Children released a minute-long video about a little girl whose life is shattered by war.
Happy birthday to you.
Make a wish.
Birthday parties and French lessons turn into air raids. Then evacuation, starvation, and finally a refugee camp. Gary Shea is Save the Children's Senior Director for Humanitarian Operations. He says the video hit home. It has 26 million views so far.
Donations did go up. People did pause, think about children, and take an action.
Before it ran, Save the Children's peer-to-peer network had raised $5,000 for Syria in 2 months. In the 10 days after the video's release, it raised $40,000. But the little girl in the video isn't Syrian. She's English. And the war-torn city is London. At the end of the video, there's a message. Just because it isn't happening here doesn't mean it isn't happening.
I think people can relate better to something that they know. It's sometimes very difficult for people to grasp the situation of these refugees, having to flee their home, having their lives disrupted, not knowing when they're going to go back.
Aid groups say something about the strife in Syria is failing to connect with donors, so some are trying to bring the conflict home. Noah Gottschalk, a senior humanitarian policy advisor for Oxfam, says a long, complicated war usually sees fewer donations than a dramatic natural disaster.
In the case of the Haiti earthquake, Oxfam America was able to raise over $30 million from the American public. Most recently, with Typhoon Haiyan, we've raised over $6 million. In the case of Syria, which has now just entered its fourth year of the crisis, we've raised less than $1 million.
This bringing the conflict home is a relatively new form of appeal, but one that has gotten some dramatic results. Lynn Kronberger is CEO of SOS Children's Villages USA, which shelters orphaned and abandoned children. She was in a business meeting earlier this year when the Norwegian chapter of SOS released a Syria aid appeal that went viral.
All of us in the room started getting Facebook notifications and alerts from friends around the world saying, "Have you seen this?"
This video wasn't filmed in Syria either, but in Norway. And once again, that was the point. A hidden camera filmed people reacting to a Norwegian boy alone at a bus stop on a winter day with no coat. Without fail, and without knowing they were being watched, people wrapped their coats and scarves around him. The message at the end? The children in Syria are cold. Donate a jacket. Norwegians donated more than $350,000 to buy those jackets. The video has also raised a question that SOS is wrestling with. If the video had featured a Syrian child, would the outpouring have been as generous? I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The president of the National Association of Theater Owners, John Fithian, has a deal for you. He wants to test out discounting movie tickets one day a week. Fithian said he is working with one state in particular, which one, he said, is a secret. Please let it be California. Please let it be California. But the plan comes at an interesting time in movie theater box office tallying. Attendance is on the decline, and yet box office revenues hit an all-time high last year. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story of how this cinematic paradox came to be.
The simple explanation is that fewer people are going to the movies, but they are paying more for their tickets. Mostly we're talking about 3D movies, which are more expensive. But higher ticket prices aren't necessarily great news for theater owners.
The model is that they share the revenues from the tickets with the studios, who get the bulk of the revenue right up front.
William Green teaches economics at the NYU Stern School of Business. Unlike ticket revenue, theaters get to keep 100% of the profits on concessions. So it's not always in their best interest to raise ticket prices. And for the most part, they haven't. When adjusted for inflation, going to a movie today isn't much more expensive than it was decades ago.
And indeed, most of the revenues that theater owners make is through the concessions and ancillary revenues.
Abraham Abid has done several studies on the film industry. That ancillary revenue includes money that theaters are now demanding to show you this.
The future belongs to those who know where they belong.
This is the movie trailer for Divergent, the number one film from last weekend. Producers now have to pay theaters to show trailers for upcoming films. Rabid says the tickets are already relatively cheap, so a discount day probably would not raise attendance dramatically, but it could be a good marketing strategy.
But nevertheless, you would expect that a decline in theater attendance, relative at least to the population, will continue as more ways of delivering movies become available.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Here's a quick update on the Russia-Crimea thing. Sanctions, they are still happening. The G8 is now the G7. NATO is peeved. It's all kind of like it used to be back in the day, the Cold War day. It is not, of course, a Cold War again. That stuff is history. It belongs in museums, which is handy because there is, in fact, a museum right here in Los Angeles dedicated to preserving the artifacts of the Cold War. Justinian Jempel is the executive director and founder of the Venda Museum. It's technically out in Culver City, California. We went out and took a tour just the other day.
So now we're going to be going to the main archive and vault, and we're going to have a look to see what's in store.
Cool.
All right, you know what this is like? This is like that scene at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark,
yes,
where you walk in that big
Love
warehouse.
That scene.
Oh, man.
Love
Are you kidding
scene.
Me?
So this is the largest collection of its kind in the world.
This is cool.
Everything
it also smells like a museum.
These are melted down brass bullets that were made by prisoners into shaped into
no,
tanks.
No, these tanks? Look
yeah.
at this.
And the tanks were, the prisoners could make some extra money by giving them to state officials as gifts. And this was a hot gift in the East Block.
Wow.
If you
yeah.
really wanted to impress somebody, you melted down brass casings of bullets and gave them as a state gift.
Checkpoint Charlie, son.
Checkpoint Charlie. We have the largest collection in the world of the border guards. And I think a lot of these guys send things because they're still politically sensitive and they're worried about what it might mean if they're sort of outed.
And they're getting them out to
and
safety,
they're
right?
getting them out here. But they don't want to throw them out either because that would be kind of throwing away their entire life's work. So we are the repository. Here's a painting of a red communist star on top of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And the logos. And so you really see this kind of idea of East meets West. And this is how this group of Hungarians were really thinking about what this was all about. That Lenin was just another form of advertisement.
Wow.
And so you get this like really cool movement in the 70s where they're starting to test this out a little bit, seeing how far they can push things.
Whole lot of Lenin busts.
Whole lot of busts. A few years ago, they weren't nearly as at risk as they are now,
right,
as we're seeing.
It must be fascinating for you now to be watching the news, surrounded by this stuff every day.
Well, you know, by the time I got into grad school and I left, they changed the name of the department from Russian East European Studies to like Slavic European Studies because there just was no interest anymore. People kept saying, look, the Cold War is over. So we have to rebrand ourselves as something else. But in a way that allowed me to go out there and start this collection because there was nobody else that did it.
And so you could get it on the cheap, basically.
You could get
right?
it. Now it's harder, of course, because now the
right,
past has become history.
Yeah.
You know? Now people think, like, oh, well, we should start to collect this stuff.
Is what's going on over there now going to make it easier for you or harder for you to get stuff from that area and from that region and stuff that matters, you know?
Right. Well, it's always an issue of trying to preserve the important stuff. I mean, we can't save everything. Nor should we. But I think it is important to make sure that we know what is out there, what's being affected. Unfortunately, we're too small of a museum to make a difference in terms of opinion.
Well, let me ask you the business model question. How do you scale from here?
That's a good question. Frankly, you know, the business model is really strange for people in the business world because we will spend a huge amount of money to acquire something that's, you know, almost nothing, or that people will give to us. But the The reality is, because this is a museum that doesn't sell anything, we're not interested in going after the thing that costs a lot of money. We're interested in going after the thing that can make a difference in terms of how we see the past. We will go out and we will invest in getting that, no matter what the cost.
Justinian Jampol, executive director and founder of the Venda Museum. It's Artifacts of the Cold War out in Culver City.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, an addendum of sorts to that Cold War Museum piece. There's a whole lot of cool stuff there, not just artifacts either. You gotta take a listen to this. Snappy little tune, huh? It was like a waxy old 45 or something, but not quite right. You know what I mean? We've got the whole song and a link to all of our Is It Another Cold War or Is It Not Another Cold War coverage on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Robbie Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Cologne, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I figure I should have learned how to say goodbye in Russian, right? I don't even know. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.